Hi, you are listening to The Floating Point on Rave Pubs Radio. I am your host, Hope Roth, here today with two great guests. I've got Chris Tatton from HB Communications and Twan Lehrenfeld from Crestron. We're going to be talking today about AV security, how to get into Crestron programming or other AV programming, and anything else we come up with along the way. So, Chris, we'll start with you. Can you just give us a little spiel about who you are, what you do, and how you got into this fun industry?
My name's Chris. I work with HB Communications. I've been there for about 15 years now, a little over 15 years, actually. And like a lot of people in AV, I kind of fell into it mostly by accident. Originally, it was just supposed to be like a between semester job as I was studying computer science at college, and next thing you know, I'm 15 years later still programming.
Great, thank you for joining us. Twan, you're not technically an AV programmer, but you have to deal with us on a recurring basis. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm Twan Lehrenfeld. I'm the technology manager at Crestron Electronics for control systems. So yes, I do deal with a fair amount of Crestron programmers and AV programmers in general. I've been at Crestron for about 13 years, and I came actually to Crestron from Wall Street as an IT manager to help Crestron become an enterprise Ethernet company.
Thank you so much for joining us. You guys are making me feel very young and also like a job hopper. I've only been somewhere for 6 years is my longest stretch of time. So I guess I got to stick around where I am right now. So today I would like to talk about security in AV, in programming, and in the Internet of Things. It's been a hot topic lately, and I know a lot of people have talked a lot about it, but we're going to do it too. And I think I had some thoughts about this last night, that AV security sort of gets talked about as this big umbrella it's sort of like a monolithic one thing that you're trying to secure. But I think there's actually two issues when it comes to securing our devices. One is the devices, their purpose. And what I heard a lot of people saying after the AMX backdoor was released was, oh, well, it's not a big deal because what's somebody going to do? They're going to switch from HDMI to VGA on the TV. Ooh, scary. Which I think is not really the right way to think about what our systems are capable of doing in terms of what hackers might want to get in and do. So that's one piece of AV security, is securing the devices for their intended purpose. You know, if it's a home, you don't want somebody going in and messing with your HVAC. You definitely don't want them messing with your security cameras, or if you have a lock. On the enterprise space, you know, video conferencing, you don't want anybody to be able to get in and listen. So I think AV security is important from that part. And then there's also the fact that our devices become sort of a pathway to your client's network. So you want to make sure that your devices are not a vector of attack. And people sort of forget that anything that has a processor and an Ethernet port on it can be used. I mean, you know, there's thousands of old printers out there that are being used every day in botnet attacks. Because people have figured out how to hack into them and use them for that method. So I'd like to talk about both of those if we can, but we don't have 6 hours to talk, so we'll try and keep it a little brief. So what are you guys' thoughts about AV security?
I'll go first, I guess. So this is Twan, for those who are listening and don't recognize my obnoxious voice. So I always take somewhat offense to the AV security part, but maybe that's because I'm an IT guy and it's just security, right? The industries have converged, so it's just security for an appliance on the network. And you're absolutely right. Your two angles are correct. I personally believe that people think that, oh boy, you can hang up a meeting, are not quite understanding that AV has moved into tying into Exchange servers and other data sources. You could see who's having meetings and what the meeting topics are, because that data is being presented to control systems and touch panels around the enterprise. And that not only gives you the ability to hang up a meeting, but now you'll even know who they're meeting with, what they're meeting about. So from that point, from data integrity point of view, data security, that is very important. I agree, hanging up a meeting is fun, but not nearly going to kill any business. But knowing what deals are being made would. So that angle, I believe, is important. But if you apply security standard security, industry standard security, sorry, you kind of take care of that by making sure all channels are encrypted and making sure that authentication is turned on so you can't even get into the box. Chris, what's your take?
Well, I mean, yeah, that definitely is accurate, especially from the corporate standpoint. We also do a lot of work with the government where, you know, aside from, you know, knowing what, you know, public corporation deals are made, you know, they use video conferencing to, you know, share classified information over secure networks. And, you know, one of the things that we constantly fight is that AV processors are not even allowed to communicate with those video conference codecs over Ethernet. They have to be completely segregated physically from that network. They were allowed nowhere near that data traffic, which obviously presents a set of problems now that, you know, more video conferencing codecs are coming without RS-232 capabilities. It makes things very difficult. But yeah, we are seeing much more demand for the security on customers' networks, and with the rise of more IT managers getting involved in IT, they're asking those questions up front. You know, how are these devices going to be secured, and making sure that their network is secure because that's their responsibility.
Right. Yeah, I forgot to mention the government. That is a very good point. Especially, you know, like the government, I don't even know how much we're allowed to say, but has different networks based on the classifications of the data. And I know that at Crestron, we're working to get on, you know, on the higher security network so that we would be able to talk to video endpoints. And that takes a lot of effort and a lot of money to get that level of certification. But fortunately, like you said, 232 is still available for most codecs, but that is going away very rapidly. And, you know, stuff like Telnet is going away on codecs and any other device, and they're all going to require encrypted communications. So as a programmer, you'll need to know what that means. What are the different kind of encryption methods being used to communicate with devices, whether it is an SSH connection for just straight commands, which I believe in the industry is also going away, and instead we're going to go to more of a HTTPS RESTful API to integrate with most devices.
That's very interesting, Tuan. Why do you think that SSH would go away versus HTTPS?
I don't think that SSH is going away per se, but what I think is that for fuller integration, devices are implementing REST APIs. Because you can do a little bit more without having to do text parsing, and you can send JSON packets and have even some streaming asynchronous information coming your way in a more structured method, I guess.
Gotcha. And I'm sure some of that, you know, is also based on some of the recent vulnerabilities that have come to light with OpenSSH and some of the other libraries that are commonly in use. You know, Heartbleed comes to mind, you know, as far as OpenSSL, et cetera. One thing I guess I wanted to ask you, Tuan, being, you know, the technology manager for the 3-series processor, is a lot of the Crestron frames are not vulnerable to those vulnerabilities because they use different technology. If there were to be some vulnerabilities discovered in the technology that you guys currently use, is that something you guys have the ability to patch on the control frames that are currently out in the wild?
If we focus on 3-series, then yes. On the 2-series, you know, that development has stopped. So, but if a massive security vulnerability was found, I'm sure we would reevaluate that decision. But yeah, so what we do, just to kind of give you a background, on the 3-series, everything gets built every night. So we have a nightly build. But before we even build, we have a tool called Coverity, which scans the source code. So all our all my engineers that are typing away on the features I'm requesting them to do get checked by an automated tool that not just checks for silly mistakes or buffer overruns in your code, but also checks against the latest security patches and best practices. So if one of my engineers were to type a password in code, hard-coded, that would get flagged and the build wouldn't go, and he would end up with some public shaming in our company.
That's actually really interesting. Good to know too. I know you talked a little bit about it in your interview with Gary at ISC, and if anyone hasn't had a chance to watch that, I would suggest that you watch it. It's pretty quick. It's a an interesting little video. Because I think one of the issues that we have in this industry is this trade-off between the way we've always done things and the way we really should do things when it comes to securing things that we never had to secure before. And I think you get some people with a mindset of, well, let's just make it easy to work. Let's just make this work. And I know that's not something that we have only in the AV industry. I sent everybody a link out earlier this week. The Nissan Leaf, their API, which their iPhone app uses, is completely insecure. Just came out this week that you can, with just the VIN of a car, you can connect in remotely, and you can't do anything with critical systems like driving or braking, but you can turn the air conditioning on, figure out where it's been, other things like that. And it's because they didn't bother to code in any sort of authentication with their API. And I'm assuming that was because it was easier. So I think it's good to know that you have a system in place that forces people to do things the hard way. Cause I know it's definitely easier to hard code, you know, something in, but at the end of the day, you want to make sure that you're not putting passwords in plain text, things like that. So if you could talk just a little bit more about how that got implemented, how it sort of works, that'd be great.
Sure. So, I mean, the tool that we use is called Coverity. And it literally has language packs. So we have a C++ and a C# pack that's what we use to develop our 3-series firmware. And every night when the nightly build starts, it goes through all the source code and finds all kinds of interesting things. For example, if you were to make two functions and they do pretty much the same thing, so you're copying and pasting. If you forget to make some changes, it goes like, you know what, you copied and pasted this code from here to here, and you didn't make any changes. That's probably not what you meant to do. So it has found some very interesting coding errors that have helped us, you know, get better firmware. But then on top of it also does a security scan, and there's some magic involved that I don't quite know how it works, but it does connect to like a CVE database of known vulnerabilities and checks through it, and it has a database of security best practices in code to prevent buffer overruns and code injection when you're using SQL. And then, of course, before we even do that, and this is something that I'm a big fan of, and in the AV industry, on the integrator programmer side, we don't do enough, is code reviews, right? Before an engineer can check in any piece of firmware code, he or she has to sit with someone else and walk it through. And often, you know, we kind of make a joke that could be a cardboard engineer, because the fact of talking through your code is enough to go, yeah, that's not going to work. Let me go fix that. But having code reviews puts you adds another layer where someone else goes like, hey, that's, you know, that has a vulnerability or that has a problem. And then after the Coverity tool runs and it's built, we run security scans against the firmware, a Nessus and Retina scan that again goes against all known vulnerabilities and tries to log into ports with default passwords and all that kind of stuff to make sure that we didn't miss anything.
You know, instead of cardboard engineers, you could get shelter dogs. They sit there and they look very interesting. Interested. They do that with kids when they're first learning to read.
That's interesting.
So you just get a very interested looking dog, your engineer will figure it out. I know I always call, whenever I call for help with something I'm doing, halfway through it, I usually figure out what the problem is, and the other person.
I somehow think Fred and Randy are going to have a problem if all of a sudden I have like 30 dogs walking the engineering building.
I know, it'd be, you just get the Crestron logo on them. Um, Chris,
I always wonder, you know, how some of this, how something like this happens. I mean, Nissan is not a small company, and let's be honest here, it doesn't take a lot of effort to secure communications via HTTPS. You know, I have to think that they have, you know, wildcard, you know, certificates that are available that they could generate secure certificates via their IT department almost at will for, you know, a subdomain. And you just wonder, like, why is this not baked into the beginning? Like, why was it never one of those thoughts like, oh, we need to make this secure right off the bat?
So if you don't mind for interrupting, I'm sorry, but security and encryption are two different things. It could have been an encrypted channel. I don't know if they're using HTTP or HTTPS. I didn't read that far enough in. The fact that all you needed to authenticate against the service was your VIN number, right? That's the problem.
No, you're right. The authentication and encryption are two very different things. Generally speaking, you should have them both, but...
Agreed.
The impression I got was that, you know, from reading the article was that there wasn't really any encryption either because, you know, they were able to view all of the HTTP.
Yeah, they injected themselves in as a proxy server, which is how they were able to figure out what the requests did. So my guess is they had no security or no encryption.
The man in the middle attacks are interesting, right? Because if you pretend to be the endpoint and then you just relay the information, you can be encrypted and people can figure it out because you will have the handshake with the endpoint. Mm-hmm. So what some of the things we do is we validate that the certificate of the device we're connecting to and the device we're connecting to is a Crestron device rather than someone else. And that's definitely part of the things they missed. As far as the reason why that didn't get caught, Chris, most likely it's like, you can turn the air conditioning on. What's the big deal? Right? It's one of those mentalities which has to change all across all industries, not just the AV industry.
Yeah. It's one of those things that I feel like security needs to be like a day one feature these days. You know, that there's too much stuff out there where security is a feature that's added after the fact. Where it's not by default. And it's a problem everywhere. You know, the Internet of Things, you know, there was a couple of days ago, the FTC just settled a lawsuit with ASUS over a vulnerability in their routers that allowed people to hijack their routers, basically saying that ASUS was negligent in not keeping their code up to date. You know, so it's good to see that there's people that are taking, you know, realizing that things need to be secure by default and actually doing something about it, at least on the government level.
Agreed. What's interesting, like on our side, so, you know, since the beginning, the 3 Series has had, at least from an enterprise authentication point of view, all the right, you know, security features in there. And as patches come out and as new develop, we... Yet, it's a tough decision to say, you know what, we're going to turn this on by default because there's this triangle of, you know, convenience, security, and cost, and you kind of don't want to give up the convenience side for deployment, especially on devices like that. But we are changing that. Like, we will be turning it on by default so that when you get that box out, you know, when you open that white box with the blue logo, you have to set up your own username and password before you can even do anything with the box, because it is important, and we're realizing that. And not just on the enterprise side or on the government side, those websites that just tell you where are Crestron devices or AMX devices, and you can just log into someone's home, are becoming readily available. And if I can go turn on your system or open your door when the locks are connected to a Crestron system or an AMX system, now it's a real security, right? It's not just, oh, I can see who is meeting with whom. It's, I can open a door, I know you're not home, and I can get in. So we need to take, you know, the industry needs to take this very seriously across the board.
I think what's so interesting about the Nissan story is not only is this an enormous company, but it's also, you know, we're talking about app development here. I mean, these are this is not just like our little industry that started up with RS-232 and we never had to worry about this stuff. You know, these are people that, you know, when we're held up against the IT industry, this is the sort of stuff that we're held up against. So there's a little schadenfreude in there, I guess, that, you know, we're not the only ones that put password on things, as the password, that everybody does this. It's sort of human nature to be lazy. And I think that's why you need to have sort of security by default, and you need to have checks and balance so that people don't get lazy. And that you sort of make them use their better nature and their better judgment. I mean, I know I sometimes have a hard time with a client explaining to them why I have to put a password on things or change their password. Or, you know, you may only be at somebody's house once a year to do updates and checks, but they have to, you know, they're there all the time. So you want to make sure that you make it so that they can get into their system and that they can use it. But at the same time, you don't want to open them up to vulnerabilities. So it's definitely a very fine line to walk. And I think that there is sort of a growing trend just in the technology industry to have security by default. So, you know, you open up, your new router from your whoever you're getting your internet connection from. And a lot of those now come with a password on them. And there's the Wi-Fi that's built into it, and it has its own password, and it's a secure password. But, you know, I set up an Xfinity router this week, and the default password on that one is password. So, you know, you've got sort of both ends of that spectrum. And I think one of our jobs as people who help others with their technology is to help them understand why having password as your password is a bad idea, and helping them to fix that.
Yeah, I was just about to make that point that you know, being the paid technical experts for these people, you know, kind of requires us to do some sort of education and explain to them when they don't understand, especially in the residential market where you're dealing with people that don't necessarily have as strong a grasp on the technology, you know, why they need to secure their systems. And fortunately, there's been enough stories like this, like the Nissan Leaf, like, you know, the Ashley Madison hack, all of that stuff that's made mainstream news, that makes it really easy to show people why they need to think about security. You know, it's not something like, oh, let's talk about this obscure company that had a security vulnerability. Let's talk about Nissan. Let's talk about Sony Pictures that had basically their entire email server dumped to the public internet, you know. So it's one of those things that people have heard these stories and understand a little bit better that this, they need to take it seriously.
I find on the residential market, though, that people still have the, yeah, but I'm not that interesting. They're not even like, they wouldn't even look at me, right? They have that, that's not going to happen to me attitude, because they believe that their little existence, or, you know, is nothing compared to Nissan or Sony or a dating site, let's call it that. They just feel like they wouldn't be a target. Like, you know, at home, we shred everything with our address on it because I don't want my identity stolen, right? So, and anything that has identifying information, we have a crossreader, and friends are like, they're not that interested in us. Like, who are we? We're not famous people. We don't have boatloads of money. Like, they're not going to come after us. And I think that the problem is they do, because, you know, many small fish end up still feeding, you know, large families, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, I completely agree with that. I mean, I don't go to the same length of, you know, everything with my address on it. They can get my address easy enough just by looking at my mail. So I'm not terribly concerned about that. But anything more than that, yeah, absolutely gets shredded. And it's, yeah, people don't realize that, you know, yeah, you're not that, they think they might not be that interesting. But there are a lot of people out there that are doing this that they will take your money, they will take your identity, and they will make your life miserable in an afternoon. You know, is that something that you're willing to bet on because you don't want to put a password on your system?
Right, exactly.
Are you willing to spend the next 6 months to 18 months of your life trying to clear your name with all of the credit reporting agencies, with credit cards, et cetera, because you just don't want to write down your password, a secure password?
And I would say for anybody who says, oh, who cares, I'm not that important, send them to any one of the websites you can find out there of pictures of sleeping babies on video baby monitors. You know, it's common enough that these video baby monitors have no security on them. They're IP enabled, and someone's figured out a way to go and scrape all of that information. And there's all these websites out there where there's just pictures of babies sleeping. And, you know, it's my kid. I put pictures of my kid online, but there's definitely something very unnerving and creepy about that. That might shock somebody into it. There was a reporter from Fusion. It was either last week or the week before. He actually asked someone to try and hack him just to see what would happen and how easy it would be. And he said it was shockingly easy, even though he uses better security than a lot of people out there. And from listening to what he had to say about it, it sounded like one of the worst parts about it was they accessed the webcam on his laptop and they got pictures of him picking his nose. You know, and they got into his bank account. They got into all sorts of, you know, more private information in terms of what people could do with it. But it, you know, it was the oh, he got a picture of me picking my nose. Now I put a sticker over my webcam when I'm not using it. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that makes you feel vulnerable.
Well, and like you said, you brought up the idea that, you know, you can do a search out there for. You know, webcams of sleeping children. You can actually do a search out there and you can find a whole bunch of vulnerable Crestron and AMX systems as well that, you know, people who have installed these systems have not, you know, considered security, that they're just wide open on the internet, just sitting there, default ports, no, you know, default passwords or no passwords that you can just access, you know, and it's not responsible as integrators to do that. You know, it's downright negligent.
Agreed.
Does anybody have any other thoughts? And I know I could probably talk for 8 hours about security, but I think we got some good discussion here.
Well, I guess one thing I wanted to ask Tuan is obviously the 3 series processor manager. And I was wondering if he felt like some of the other aspects of Crestron were as up to date with thinking of security by default.
Yes, we are, as a whole, we started a what we call a network interrupt group, and all managers are part of that, talking about what are best practices for security. The Coverity thing is happening on all our code bases, software and firmware, across all platforms. And, you know, we're putting standards in place. The challenge are some of these smaller devices, right? Like a 3 series has a pretty powerful processor. The bigger DM frames do, the touch panels all do. They can do Active Directory and SSL and SSH and TLS and all this other good stuff, all the acronyms we love to hear. But the smaller free-scale processors or the little Motorola's, they don't have that kind of horsepower. So, you know, that's why something like a control subnet helps you put those devices off the corporate network and on its own private network. You can put it in an isolation mode so that you can guarantee to the IT manager that these devices never even communicate on the corporate network. So, yeah, we are taking that very serious across the board. All the best practices I was talking about on the 3 series are happening across all our platforms, including software like Fusion and Simple Windows.
That's good stuff. Thank you for sharing some of your process with us. Maybe on future shows we can have some other companies on and find out how they do it as well. Anyone out there that wants to come in and talk about how they're implementing security, I'm sure this will be a recurring topic. Moving along. We put some question out to Twitter. This is sort of our beta show. I would almost say this is our first episode, so we're still sort of figuring out how things are going to go. But I'd like to do some audience participation because I know there's a lot of people out there who are talking about this stuff, and we've talked to a lot of people on AV Power Up who are interested in becoming programmers, AV programmers. I would recommend Crestron programming, but that's my own personal thing. So we asked
Me too,
Twitter.
By the way.
Yeah, we are sort of a Crestron-centric show today, but you go with what you know. We put a question out to Twitter. We said, you know, what would you ask very smart people? And I guess I would include myself in that one, about AV programming, control programming. And we got a great question from Barry, and I'm sorry if I get your name wrong. I think it's Sato. He's at Barry H. Sato, S-A-T-O. And he said, what is the best method, language, or platform for an AV designer? So this is somebody who's sort of speccing out systems, putting them together, to get started in control programming. I'm going to put this one out to everybody. So this is probably somebody who has a high level of knowledge of the industry and is probably pretty smart. He follows me on Twitter, so obviously he's smart. And so you know, you don't have to start at the very beginning. So where would you dive in? And I think that's an interesting question because, you know, obviously the person from Crestron is going to say Crestron. But even within that, you know, do you start with simple Windows? Do you start with simple Sharp? What's the best way to dive in?
I think the best way to dive in is to take a programming course. And I don't care what language you pick. You need to know algorithms and understanding how to break down problems into smaller parts. And until you are familiar with programming, going and diving into simple Windows, which is pretty straightforward, or Studio with some of the automated tools. A lot of problems we see are people who just kind of taught themselves, if you will, and they make mistakes that if you had a programming background, you probably would not have made. I would recommend go to Lynda, lynda.com, and take some programming and it can even be theories, like just object-oriented programming, some algorithmic stuff, so that at least you kind of know how to break down problems and address them.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement. I've seen a lot of people come into AV and try to learn programming without a programming background or any sort of formal education in programming. And they're able, through a lot of unneeded effort, to make it work in an unelegant way, just through sheer brute force of trying different things. But when you ask them, well, why does it work and how does it work? They're not able to answer that for you because they don't have the background in how to actually solve the problems and how to take problems that, you know, look very daunting and break them down and to say, this is the information I have. This is the information I need. How do I convert from A to B, you know, knowing that there may be many, many steps that you need to take in order to do that. So I absolutely agree with Juan that you need to have some sort of programming background outside of AV first to really learn the basics before you try to get into AV programming. You know, Crestron has, you know, programming courses. But one of the things that I've said is that Crestron, you know, can show you the tools. They can show you how to work with the tools, but they cannot teach you how to be a programmer in 5 business days in a class of 20 people. Like they can help you if you have a background. They can help you to understand how to work with their specific hardware. But there's just, I mean, people spend 4 years of college learning how to program. You know, it's not something that you can just go in there and take care of in 40 hours in a classroom.
Right, I agree. We teach our tools and our language. We don't teach programming. And I don't think anyone in the industry does, right? They all just teach you how to do it within their tool set.
Yeah, I don't think you guys are, you know, that's... AMX is the exact same way. They teach you how to do things in their specific framework. You know, when I started in the industry, because my background was more of a C++ background, I actually started with AMX programming because it was much easier to digest from the information that I already had. You know, granted, some of the syntax is different, but most of the structures between, you know, the old access language and C++ are kind of the same. You know, it's a very stripped down version, but it's still line code. And simple Windows took a little bit more time to pick up because it is very different than what's out there for other programming languages. You know, I equate it to much more like designing a circuit board than actually, you know, writing code.
And that's what it is.
Yeah, it's programming for people who think about ins and outs, or gazindas and gazadas if you're old school. And I think it's actually kind of interesting that we have both me and Chris on the show today, because we both took comp sci classes in college. I was a comp sci major as well. And we're pretty rare in this industry, partially just because a lot of people with comp sci degrees get jobs at Google and get paid a lot more than I do. And partially just because we sort of, programming is sort of considered a career boost in our industry, I think. You know, you pay your dues, you work as a tech, which I did. I was on site switching out projector lamps and, you know, replacing filters and everything, and you work your way up and you get into programming is sort of seen, I think, as a career progression. But really, you know, the best programmers out there do everything in pseudocode, in at least in their head, if not up on a board. And they think they're the problem. And I think it actually does circle a little bit back around to security, which is, if you're just bashing your fingers on the keyboard trying to make something work with an SIO or something, you know, security becomes, it's not even an afterthought, because you're just trying to make your system work. Whereas if you understand what you're trying to do, you understand your platform, you understand sort of the algorithm that you're trying to use, then security becomes a built-in, baked-in feature of that. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that, you know, we have in the industry of finding good programmers, is that, you can't just send them to a 5-day class. And I think you also get this sort of natural, push pull of simple windows will get my job done, and I have 6 jobs to take care of next week. But, you know, simple Sharp, gives me all sorts of better tools, and is the one that I would like to focus on.
Yeah, no, I agree. I actually just spent a week in our shop working with a product, and spent the entirety of my time of development, you know, just interfacing with this product within Visual Studio, writing a simple Sharp module for it, because it's just so much more powerful than anything out there as far as, you know, AV programming. You know, I haven't seen... Personally, for me in our company, I don't see as much of a benefit for Simple Sharp Pro for us, because we have we're very unique in the industry, is that in the company wide, we have almost a dozen, if not more, programmers on our staff between our 3 offices. And obviously, we have varying levels of skill, and not everybody is as well versed in Simple Sharp, let alone Simple Sharp Pro, as everybody else. So, you know, if I were to write something in Simple Sharp Pro, which I don't even have that much experience with, you know, there would be an issue where I would end up having to support it, and there would be nobody else that could even I could even consider sending out to support that project. I would essentially be chained to it for life, or at least for a good long time, which isn't necessarily something that, you know, I'm interested in. Likewise, I have a lot of modules that I've built up over the past 15 years in Simple Windows and Simple Plus that I know work, and that are, you know, tried and true, and they don't have to worry about having to think about, let me re-engineer this. You know, at the end of the day, I still have projects that I need to get done quickly, and it's something that, you know, I can't waste the time necessarily right now to translate them all into Simple Sharp Pro. So, I mean, Simple Sharp itself is absolutely the way to go for most things that I would normally do in Simple Plus. But I just personally don't necessarily see a ton of benefit to Simple Sharp Pro for my company yet.
I get that. And I think a lot of companies are in that same kind of vein, where they have a lot of traditional AV programmers. What I've seen several companies do now is hire actual C-sharp kids, if you will, straight out of college, and they just dive into the Simple Sharp Pro. And for those listening that don't know the difference, both of them are C-sharp languages. One are modules you drop into our traditional Simple Windows modules programs, and the other one is writing your entire program in C-sharp. So we've had a couple of residential and even commercial dealers that hired kids out of college to write a framework for a Simple Sharp Pro program where everything is done over on a configuration basis rather than a you know, recompile because I added a projector to the program basis. So I think that it will shift. But yeah, if you have many years of intellectual property in Simple Plus, switching over to Simple Sharp Pro would cost you a lot of man hours.
Twan, when you hire, I know that you're not really hiring people to do the Crestron programming side of things, but at Crestron, I know you have people that do sort of internal projects and write code. Is Crestron hiring people mostly who are, you know, comp sci majors and are trying to do things in Simple Sharp, or where's your talent pool coming from? If you don't mind my asking.
No, not at all. All our internal development is now in Simple Sharp and Simple Sharp Pro. So we are hiring, we are always looking for people with a comp sci major with C Sharp knowledge.
Yeah, it was kind of my understanding that part of where Simple Sharp came from was so that you could get that base of people that you could hire to make it easier to get people with a comp sci degree because it's something that they're used to working with.
Well, that and just the amount of development like a ping and an AV framework would not have been possible. So yeah, Simple Sharp and Simple Sharp Pro was completely self-serving on our end because we needed to make developments and feature sets available to our customers that weren't possible before we had those two languages. And the fact that people like Chris and Mark Coleman's in the world can write in C Sharp as well is a fringe benefit, but a very nice one.
I've written one module so far. I'm still working on it. But if anyone out there is trying to decide if it's worth getting the software and playing around with it, it definitely is because it opens up just a whole new realm of tools that you can use. So Barry, if you are listening, the answer is go out, go to lynda.com, learn how to be a programmer. Anyone who is a programmer can be an AV programmer, and I would definitely agree with everyone on that. I know that when I was in my comp sci degree, we a lot of times worked in algorithms and theory, and I had classmates that said, you know, I just want to learn how to write the line code so I can get the job done. But learning the theory is what has allowed me to pick up other programming languages along the way, you know, so I taught myself other languages to make things work if I'm doing, you know, stuff on the web. And then when I came into Crestron programming, it helped me because it helps you to sort of think things through logically, rationally. For anyone who doesn't know what pseudocode is, it's where you're not actually writing line code or simple Windows code. You're actually just on a blackboard or a piece of paper, you're just sort of writing out what the flow of information is and how it's going to work. And if you can do that, you can be an AV programmer. So, please continue sending us questions in. I think it gets us a great ability to have a conversation and a conversation that people want to hear. If you like what you hear, please reach out to us. If you don't like what you hear, I guess do the same. And we're going to try and wrap things up. I want to thank both Chris and Twan for joining us today. Great conversation. Any final thoughts? And then my fun question for the day is, what is the AV system at your house? Did it fall off the back of a truck? And how much time do you spend working on it? I will fess up that everything in my house that hasn't been purchased in the last few months is about 10 years old. And my AV system in my house is a bit of a cobbler's barefoot child. But how about you guys?
I'll let Twan go first.
Oh, that is so not fair.
I think Twan probably gets a much better discount than we do.
None of it is off the back of a truck. It is all Crestron, pretty much, with the exception of my TiVos and my Roku box. And most of it is nowadays beta gear that I get from being a technology manager and being involved at the earlier stages of direction and development. Before that, I did use our employee discount to purchase some gear like my Pro 3.
I have a couple of things too that have been, they didn't necessarily fall off the back of the truck, but they are development gear. that has been installed in a rack that slot one just happens to control the stuff in my house. And slots 9 through 10 are available, or 2 through 10 are available for actual development. But yeah, I've got a good handful of stuff. I have purchased stuff through Crestron before, through the what my rep was able to get me as a discount. But it's probably about half and half.
You know, I say it tongue in cheekly, but I think it is important to work with this stuff at home and to understand how it works and to play with things in your free time if you have it. And also just to learn what's annoying to live with. You know, a couple of the ideas I've had of something that I think would be really cool, I very quickly discovered were not so cool when you use them every day. So I want to thank you for joining us. I want to thank everyone for listening. One quick PSA, if you want to be a Crestron programmer, my company is hiring. We're looking for someone in the New York or Southern Connecticut area. Please save me from day trips to New Haven. Please reach out over Twitter. I'm at beer and pie. You can also send me an email, hope@reardonbrothers.com. If we are looking for somebody who's a little higher up. So if you've never done Crestron programming before, probably not the best step. But if you have some experience and you think you might enjoy working with me, please reach out. I want to thank our guests for joining us today. I guess we'll wrap up. Thank you for listening. This has been The Floating Point on Rave Pubs Radio.